Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. Today is episode 147 with the title Breaking Bias. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Lorne Epstein. Lorne is a social scientist, keynote speaker, facilitator, and has been transforming workplaces for over two decades by teaching people how to recognize and reduce unconscious bias. When I asked Lorne to describe his superpower, he said, helping professionals uncover and mitigate their biases. Hello, Lorne. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joe. Thank you so much for having me. I'm on 147.
Yeah, episode 147. Where's that time gone? We met. When did we meet? It was 2019 in Amsterdam, was it?
Yes, it was 2019 in Amsterdam. So that's 5 years ago.
Yeah, long time. Wow. It was Unleash, if I remember rightly, the HR conference.
Yeah. That was great. That was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed kind of seeing the European HR market. And it blew me away. I mean, people were just so great, very friendly. You know, still crazy like the HR people here, but it was nice.
At that conference, you were doing live interviews, and I was a guest on your show, if I remember correctly.
Yes. So like in 2015, where I live, they opened up a public radio station, and I got a radio show, and I made it all about jobs. And I was just doing it as a side thing. It was just for fun. There was no money because it was a public station. And then the last year or so, I started figuring out ways to make money. And one was to get sponsorships and go to shows like Unleash and interview folks. So I did that for about a year or so. And then everything kind of went to shit because of COVID and, you know, the whole... Anyway, so yeah, that's how we met.
Yeah, we did. We touched base, if that's not too cliched an expression, a few times early in COVID. And you really got into the unconscious bias and your business took off in that route, didn't it?
Yeah. It was kind of wild. I had a federal client, a federal government agency was a client of mine. I was developing their national hiring strategy, their diversity hiring strategy. And while I was doing it, their head of HR asked me to build them an unconscious bias workshop. And I'd been doing experiential training for decades. So I did it for them. They loved it. And since then, I probably did it like 30 or 40 times. Just as 2020 started in January, an old college professor of mine suggested, why don't you submit it to this experiential learning conference in Philadelphia and get some feedback? And I'm like, that sounds great. So I applied and it got accepted. But I also applied to graduate school. I was going to get a master's degree in organizational development, and I got accepted. But there was a conflict on that date. My teacher said, well, you can't go to the conference. You have to come to class. Why don't you just do the workshop for the students and get feedback? I said, that sounds great. So we set it up, and the school had advertised that it was going to be on campus. And next thing you know, we have COVID. And in April of 2020, instead of doing it in person, we did it on Zoom. I had 140 people from around the world in this workshop, and it just took off. People wanted more. So the next month we had 100, and since then over 50,000 people have done these trainings.
I think I actually crashed into one of your workshops in the early ones. It was the first or the second. I sat in on one of them, the early ones, I think.
Was it fun?
It was great. I thought it was great. I mean, I mean, the experiential side, we were in breakout rooms. I met some people, had great conversations. And yeah, it was my first, probably my first experience of doing that online experiential type training where you're just going into breakout rooms. I think it probably helped me get confidence in delivering some of my own workshops online as well.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome. That's great. I love that. I love hearing how the work that we do makes a difference for people. It's not something that like naturally happens. And it's funny you should say that because I know that I make a difference for people. It's like, I love people and I want to just support them in having better lives. About 4 weeks ago, I was training almost 1,000 people at a hospital in Ohio. And midway through, my sponsor, who is the CHRO, we were walking across campus and she said, you remember this woman where we had a little bit of, you know, we had some challenges with, and she came to my office after the workshop and she gave me a thumbs up and she said, that's the kind of training that we need. And my heart just melted. I just stopped and I'm like, I got all warm and fuzzy and I'm like, oh my God, this is great. This is like, you know, my wonderful life moment of it actually, something is actually happening. But, you know, like, you know, and I was telling you this story earlier, there's like all this other stuff that has to occur for that one little moment. So like 3 weeks ago, I was speaking at the HR Visions in London, and I'd gotten there on a Monday. I got 4 hours of sleep because the time changed, did a workshop on Tuesday, got 4 hours of sleep, did another workshop on Wednesday, came home. Towards the end of the flight, the plane got just crazy turbulent. I got so sick that they took me off by ambulance, went to the hospital for about 3 or 4 hours, got fixed up. Next morning, I get up, I do another workshop for a client on Zoom, go to class, pick up my assignment, go to the airport, fly to Michigan, because the next day I'm training 100 doctors. And like, all that was great because of that one little, like, I know somewhere someone's going to go like, oh, that was really good. That made a difference in my life. Have you had that experience?
Yeah, I've had an in-flight issue, and I'll tell you about that. When I run my in-person or even my online workshops, and you're doing your discovery call with a client, or you're just about to go into the room and do the training, quite often they take me to one side and go, Joe, just so you know, there's a couple of people who are really anti, they're kind of really negative, they're real troublemakers, they don't want to get involved with this inclusivity rubbish or mumbo-jumbo that's on it. I said, that's brilliant. That's what I want. I don't want everyone to go in there and agree with me. I want people in there who are going to be feisty and testy, because it has two purposes. One is it gives an example of the problem we have to the people who are positive, so they actually hear this. But also, I found the people who go with those really deep, struggling ideas, they come out with most change. Often they come up to me after, shake my hand or give me a hug or something, and say, that's so powerful. Wow, you've really opened my eyes to this. So that's where you really find you've made the difference. But nudging people who are already there, it's the echo chamber. It's not where the satisfaction is. It's the moving people from A to B where you can clearly see changes occur. That's where the empowerment comes in.
Yeah, I love that. Like, there's a lot more people. Like, I love people. I met a bunch of coaches. So I did a training from a company called LifeSpring back in 92, which was my big kind of transformational moment of seeing my own power and letting go of the wounds. And coaching wasn't a thing then. And now so many people do that. And I know that's like the benefit they get. The why is they just want to connect and help people. And I think a lot of people listening to the show are like, you know, like that's what they want to do. They just want to make a difference.
Hmm. Yeah, they do. I mean, I've got to give you my wellness story now on a plane. So I used to work for a bank in the UK, and this bank was a private bank, and they had branch offices all over the world in very nice places, Beverly Hills, San Diego. And this particular occasion, I was doing IT. So I was an IT tech, effectively, rolling out systems. And this particular gig was Nassau, Bahamas. So I flew from London. And in those days, British Airways used to fly via Miami, and then you change at Miami, and then you go Miami, Nassau. The mid-flight, the plane had an emergency landing. I think it was that someone had a heart attack. So we had to land in Gander in Newfoundland. I don't know if you've ever had an emergency stopover in Newfoundland, but Basically the plane does a really rapid descent, and suddenly you land on this airfield in the middle of Newfoundland, middle of nowhere. You look out the window, you can't see anything. The absolutely wild landscape, and they get the person off. And of course, when they're on the tarmac, they have to turn all the air conditioning off, all the flight, they're in flight entertainment. You're basically sat there. And you sat there for like 3 or 4 hours because they can't get a flight path to take off again. So you're stuck there until they can get another air traffic control slot. And they walk around handing out these packs of sandwiches. And I had a prawn sandwich, a shrimp sandwich. And about just before we land in Miami, I'm starting to think, I really don't feel good. I'm really not feeling this anymore. And when you have that sort of kind of food poisoning, you can tell what did it to you, can't you? Your brain knows what it was. And I think, that's the prawn. That's definitely prawn that's giving it to me. So I get to Miami and my sweat is pouring off me. I'm sweating. I get through passport, managed to find the toilets. And I'm at, unfortunately, both ends. And and I was sweating. Oh. And then because we had this issue with the landing in Newfoundland, and my flight to the Bahamas was then, I missed my connection. We had to get another connection or this sort of thing. When I got to the Bahamas in this state, I was missing my luggage. So there I am in Nassau, Bahamas, in the temperature. I can't remember what time of year it was, but it was hot. Bahamas is generally hot any time you go there, but this was hot. Yeah. And I turn up with no luggage. I get to the, I was sharing like an Airbnb equivalent in the 90s, whatever it was. Yeah, it was a flat with a load of people also working for the bank. And someone ended up lending me this T-shirt. And I looked like, I don't know, this T-shirt, like 3 sizes too small. But I had to have something because I just drifted. I had no luggage. I remember going to sleep that night in a room. And all I could hear was mosquitoes. It was like they were dive bombing me. I was like, bzz, bzz, bzz. And all night, all I could feel was these mosquitoes everywhere. I had no luggage. I felt awful. I felt sweaty. So I feel your pain, that turbulence, and then having to go to work that day covered in mosquitoes with food poisoning and no luggage in the Bahamas.
Wow.
It's a glamorous life, isn't it?
So, thankfully, that's scary. That's scary because you were like far away from things. But thankfully, my wife was there. It was just a few hours and I felt fine. Like that whole experience, while it sounds tumultuous, I say it's like it was a great week and I love my job. Like I love that week because I love my job. But yeah, I get it, man. I get that. That's it's scary being sick. Anyway.
Yeah. In a foreign country and you've got all this stuff to do. You've got to get onto another plane. I mean, Miami is a big airport. If you've got to go from domestic to internal, international to domestic, it's a long walk. And I was feeling, and no luggage, and I was sweating, and it was just the whole stress.
When did you feel better? Did you get better like quickly, or was it like?
I think by the next morning, I was okay again, and they managed to find my luggage. It was on the next flight. I went back to the airport, and there it was on the carousel, picked it up. And had a shower and a change and put some clothes on. I was fine again. But yeah, it was a probably about 12 to 24 hours of stress I didn't need.
Wow, yeah, it sounds like it. So but what got you
a couple
into
of days later,
doing
we were jet skiing you, later. So, wait, sorry.
I wanted to ask, what got you into doing this show?
What it was I was having conversations, because I started the business in 2017, and I found myself having lots of cups of coffee. You go to London, you're networking. I'd stack the coffees up all day. So I go meet people at this cafe, meet people in this cafe, meet people. And I was having these great conversations with people trying to build my network up. And then I started doing a few online meets and Zoom calls in the early days. And we'd finish the Zoom call and we'd have this really great conversation. I'd say, I wish we'd recorded that. I wish we recorded that. And that's how it came, really. I decided that all these conversations I'm having should be captured and we can actually turn them into something. So I decided pre-COVID, this is pre-COVID, I wanted to have conversations. And I use the podcast as a way of networking, having conversations with people and capturing these stories for posterity, for historical reference, or just to share with other people. So that's what started it, really, just that desire to share conversations.
Awesome. To make a difference.
Yeah. Make a difference, absolutely, to make a difference. And
yeah.
And to feel that there's a purpose beyond just a chat, which goes into the ether and it gets forgotten. Because I have one of these brains that is, I find it very difficult to remember certain things. Like if I go to the cinema, the next day I've forgotten half the film. I don't remember what it was. If I meet people, I forget their name really, really quickly. And because again, you're doing so many Zoom calls, so many meetings. I meet hundreds of people a month, and you can't remember everybody. And I found that I was having this conversation with people. Say, oh, yeah, it's good to see you again. I go, okay, go on and remind me, where did we meet before? And yeah, and this is just a great way of having conversations. And I still do it. I go on LinkedIn sometimes and invite people to the podcast. And they say, we did one last year. Did we? Sorry, you're quite correct. Yes, we did. But yeah, I have got one of these memories that is very good at certain things, but very bad at other things. I think my brain just optimizes out and says the separation between need to remember and doesn't matter. And if you fit into the doesn't matter pile, I'll never remember that conversation again. But we obviously had a lasting impression because meeting you in Amsterdam all those years ago and keeping in loose contact, not active contact with each other. I get your newsletter. I see you doing stuff on LinkedIn and stuff. So I guess you've penetrated into the must remember pack.
That's funny you should say that because a year and a half ago, I started another master's in cognitive neuroscience. And this past semester, in fact, just last week, I had my final in neuroscience of memory and learning. And so I learned very minutiae about how the brain works around memory and learning. Yeah, and our brains are not all the same, right? Particularly around memory and learning. And the parts of our brain that do a memory, it's really unclear. Like there are some things that are clear, but some things are just like, in every class I've taken, usually sometime during the class, the teacher's like shrugs their shoulders and says, and we don't know.
Yeah. There's loads of stuff, you know, I will be able to pull something out of my memory somehow. And I'll pluck something out. It'll be a random fact or an anecdote or something. And I'll just drop it into the conversation. And my wife will look at me and go, you heard that yesterday, didn't you, on that show? And I went, yeah. She said, you're making it sound like you know what you're talking about. I said, well, I just hoover up knowledge and then I know when to spit it back out again. But I couldn't tell you how I remember or what I remember. It just becomes a nugget that gets delivered into my tongue and out of my mouth at the right moment at the right time. But you ask me about it now, I wouldn't be able to remember what's that? Really?
You're probably really good at making matches because when we have a memory, it gets broken up and stored in different places. So the visual component of the memory would be stored in one part of the brain and another part of the memory would be stored in another part of the brain, like a database, right? And then there's like something that links it all together and then that occurs and then it can brings back the memory or it could bring back parts of the memory.
Okay, so it's a bit random retrieval. It's indexed, yeah.
Right. And another thing I learned was that our brain extinguishes memory, right? So we don't remember everything that happens. Imagine if you remembered everything that happens, right? It would be very hard to function. And so there's a whole system in our brain that allows us to extinguish memories, which is really important for people with PTSD and depression and other mental illnesses, that you can actually cause your brain to not remember something. You can weaken those connections.
Yeah, I realized that our daughter's, 32 years old now. And when we get together, you know, you do the reminiscing, don't you? Humans like telling stories of the past and reminiscing and bringing things. The way our daughter tells a story about our holidays or an event we did, and she has a different memory than I do. And sometimes I'll go, no, I just don't remember that at all. And I'll say, well, what about this? And she said, well, I don't remember that. So we've all latched on. This is part of the bias and the way our brains work, isn't it? Where we store emotion with these memories. We store feelings and different things resonate with us. And if they're not memorable, we just, as you say, purge them. Don't store them at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Some things are just too, like, not interesting to store.
Yeah. But to other people, they're meaningful.
100%.
But you get the same in crime, you know, police asking for photo fits and all recalling what did the perpetrator or the bad guy look like. And everyone has a different view. Everyone remembers the color of his jacket was blue and everyone said, no, no, it's green. And no one said, no, he didn't have a jacket on at all. And everybody makes this stuff up about, they rewrite their own memories, don't they?
Yeah, there's a reason for that because, you know, one of the things that's great about our brains, and this is getting to the conversation around bias and why we have biases, is that we fill in the blanks, right? If I tell you three pieces of information, you'll connect them and make up a story, right? That, like when you watch a movie, they don't usually show you every moment of like the protagonist's day. but you know, you think like, oh, they went from here to here, and you in your mind, you go, okay, that makes sense, or how they did it. And that's how we have these biases. And because they're unconscious, we're not aware of them, they're always occurring. You know, if you drive by somebody's house and you look at the house and you see there's a car and there's a middle-aged guy washing the car and a little child helping, well, who's the guy? That's dad, right? That's the father.
Probably.
And yeah. Right. And that the little person's the son. And if there's a woman who's about the same age, that's probably the mom. And like, if there's an older woman, probably the grandmother, right? So we make all these things up so we can make sense of the world. You know, the brain that we have is, you know, version 10 of hominids. You know, we're about 300,000 years old, Homo sapiens, but we're not the first version of hominids. And the brain that we have was created, not just the brain, but the brain and all the nervous system, right? The sympathetic nervous system, the parasympathetic nervous system, the somatic, all the nerves in our body were created when the world was really dangerous, right? It was, you know, dangerous 300,000 years ago. So when you think about, well, if it's dangerous, what do? We have a brain that is super responsive to danger. And even though we don't have those kind of deathly fears now, we have psychological fears, right? Like, primary reason for your show is that people feel like they belong, because not what happens when somebody doesn't feel like they belong?
Well, they're at their comfort zone. That buzzwords like psychological safety, they feel part of something, they feel strangers, they feel their fight, flight, freeze mechanism is there, they're hyper alert, all these kind of, as you say, the parasympathetic nervous system's kicking in, the vagus nerve's triggered, adrenaline's flowing, everything. You just feel uncomfortable, you don't feel you can relax, all those kind of feelings, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same thing that we felt when a lion was coming after us.
Hmm.
But now it's, I don't feel like I belong in this group, or I think these people don't like me.
Yeah, you're not going to give your best self, are you? What you're going to do is you either want to run away or hide or just keep looking for the exit. Yeah.
Or attack somebody.
Yeah, or attack somebody. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're on that defensive mode all the time, aren't you? I always think about it as... that old sitcom, Cheers. Remember the Canadian sitcom, oh, yeah. Cheers, a bar where everyone knows your name. That always conjures up that sense of belonging. You walk in there, you got your stool, you got your friends. They know your name, they know your drink. You just fit back into it like you were only just left, and it could be 3 years later. You just pick up where you left off, and that's how I feel about belonging. That coffee shop. That you know it's your coffee shop. And if you go to the other coffee shop, the other end of town, it's just not your coffee shop, is it? The chair's not as comfortable. The beans aren't as nice. That they're not roasting it the same. You just know that where you feel that sense of we can relax and let yourself go.
So you're in England, you have that with pubs, right?
Yeah, people have their preferred, their local, their preferred place after work, whatever. Yeah, I used to have a place like that in Zurich. Actually,
really?
I was working out the same bank. I was working out. We ended up in Bahamas. I worked in Zurich for about 8 or 9 months, and I was going out, flying in and out every weekend. And on the Thursday night before we flew back on the Friday, we always used to go and have a night in the old town in Zurich. And there's a bar hotel called the Adler, which is eagle translated from German. And it was a piano bar. So we used to go there. We'd probably get there about, I don't know, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night after being doing the old town and doing the bars. And we'd walk in there, and there was this big, gregarious barman that was always there. He had massive, big, wide red braces on, a big stripy shirt. And we'd walk in, he'd look at us, and he'd point his finger and go, "It's there." You walk out to the bar, and there's your double vodkas and tonics on the bar waiting for you. The piano kicks in. We all stand by the piano. We're singing along. And that was our place. We were there every Thursday night. Every Thursday night for a year.
Wow.
And we'd end up flying with a hangover the next day because it was that good. We'd get in at 4 a.m. or something. But yeah, that's our belonging. So yeah, pubs, yeah, bars, pianos, sing songs. Yeah.
Yeah. And so how do we, I think probably the question you think about a lot is how do we make where we are a place of belonging, right? That people can not just, like when you would go to the bar, in a way, the barkeep created this place, right? You were open, but the barkeep created the place. So like, how do we own ourselves, own our power, own our the way we can create context and create that where we are, no matter what, right?
I think sometimes what I find I have to do is nudge people to have that visual memory of what belonging feels like, which is why I always use the coffee shop or that story about the bar in Zurich, about Cheers, those sort of things. Trying to get people to think about what belonging means to them. And that's, once you get into that zone, you go, actually, I know what belonging feels to me. And then you go, right, okay, now we understand how that feels to you. How do we create that feeling for others? I think that's what we've got to try and do, create these relatable experiences. Otherwise, we're just trying to manufacture our version of belonging. Everyone has their own sense, don't they?
Yeah, that's true. I think like every time I've spoken to you, Joe, over the last few years, I always feel like there's a sense of belonging. And I think in part, I feel accepted by you. Like, I don't think, for me, it's like, I think I could say anything. I don't think you're going to judge me or judge me harshly. And I mean, I think I experience you as just having an open heart, right? I think those are the ways of being that as humans, we are when we want to embrace folks. And I know before I've met people, I know I've had my back up. Either I've had a judgment about them and like no matter what they say, I'm probably going to judge them. But when I don't, that gives the opportunity, the space for connection and intimacy, like not physical intimacy, but like, you know, just that emotional intimacy. And sometimes I think what happens is that someone would meet, you know, someone meets me and without me saying anything, I make the way I look or the way it triggers in them something to either be safe or not be safe. And that's where this gets really interesting, right? Like, so what is it about the person that you're about to see that triggers your sense of safety without them saying anything, whether it's founded or unfounded? Because sometimes it could be founded. Like I grew up in Brooklyn and I know some streets, like if I was walking down the street, I would like, I know it's scary. It's probably dangerous, but we still have that. Right. And we don't take a moment to pause and just kind of consider, like, what do I really know? What do I know about this person? Like, what can I say? Will they harm me? Can they harm me?
Yeah. I don't know about you, but I mean, we're effectively solopreneurs. We're delivering, we're selling, we're relationship building, we're keeping our business going. And we know that people buy from people. So we've got to be a people first person in order to create relationships, in order to build trust, in order to do all these things. So I'm very conscious about, and I use the expression as part of my sales pitch, if you like, about creating positive people experiences. So what I'm trying to do is always create a positive experience with people I meet. And that's kind of how I try and encourage people to treat others. If you go in with the end in mind, and the end in mind is a positive experience, then the journey is likely to be with that as a destination. You're more likely to achieve it. If you go in with a grumpy, frowny face, a bit dismissive, not interested, no eye contact, don't care about the other person's experience, then it's not going to go positively, you know, generally. So I say, I always try and go into conversations with a warm, open heart, a smiley, open expression, engaging to try and treat everybody like an old best friend, even if I've met them for the first time. And it just creates that, try and focus on creating that warmth from the off, really, to break down the barriers.
Joe, I think that's one of the keys is like you have a primary value, right? Like your values and your principles are what everything sits on. We all have values and principles, the things that don't change, the immutable. And you have a value of that, right? So if that is your value, then of course you're going to come to the conversation in a particular way. Like I have a story I share in my workshop, right? Where I walked into a store, a guy came up on my left, turns down the aisle. It was a drugstore. He reaches up, grabs something. And as he grabs it, everything comes tumbling down. And I see this and I judged him harshly, really harshly, right? And I keep walking. I realize he's behind me. I'm getting to the cashier. And in my mind, I'm thinking, and now I have to punish him. So what I'll do is I'll go slow. And this whole dialogue in my head took about a second and a half. And as soon as I realized I wanted to harm him, I stopped. I stopped. And the only reason I stopped was because I have a bigger commitment to not harm people, like ever. right? No matter what, I will not harm somebody consciously, right? So I can be aware. So that kind of brought me out of my kind of my mind. And I was able to then ask myself questions like, one, do I know he picked it up? No, I don't. Maybe he did. Maybe he was in a rush. Maybe he has a sick kid. Maybe I could have been helpful and let him get in front of me. And then I came to, does it even matter? And I'm like, no, it doesn't matter. You know, like when I'm driving and people do crazy things, I just let it be because it doesn't matter. I don't beep. I don't react because it doesn't matter. Like it's, you know, and so that's like, and everyone has to kind of come to their own values and principles about how they want to be in the world and how they want to experience people and how they want to have people experience themselves. But I think generally speaking, we're social beings, right? We're here to be together. We're here to live and die together. We succeed together, right? And that kind of, I think that's an immutable truth about human beings is when we tap into that, that we all want to do good. We all want to be cared for and loved and connected, then whatever's true for us about that and however that principle evolves itself, manifests itself, then we have a world where people do feel like they belong.
But you have to realize, I mean, you obviously appreciate this, the person you are having that, I've got to police this person and tell them what I think. They have their own perspective of that incident. As you say, they may have been rushing. They may have a sick person. They may not even notice. They didn't realize they were doing it to you. They were in their own little world. And so your perspective of what occurred is different to theirs. They see that their reality was different to yours. Right. And as you say, most people are kind by default. And it's the difference in perspective or where what's going on in the world that differentiates how you perceive something. And I think that's I always hold that to heart. Yeah. I don't have to be right because I'm not always right. I just have my perspective and it's up to you. Me telling you what I feel is, it's important sometimes, but I don't have to win. I don't have to be right.
Yeah. And those two things you said, I don't have to be right. I don't have to win are key. Like they are the steps. You have to embrace that. If you want to create belonging, you have to embrace that. And I think that comes either with, you know, maturity or wisdom, or you were lucky enough to be born in a culture where people didn't want to be right more than they wanted to be loved. But I know where I live, a lot of people just want to be right. I mean, I live in a world where people want to be right versus being loved, right? You look at war, you look at poverty, you look at inequitable situations in our world. It's about people being right versus people being loving and kind.
The example I often give to people is I've been married for over 37 years, and you don't stay married by wanting to be right. Either of us, you know.
You don't stay happily married.
Oh, we are happy. Yeah, so happy married.
Because people can be unhappily married for 50 years and just be tolerating each other.
So you've got to, if you're holding that prisoner of righteousness, and you want to say but you don't, it's having children, having maintaining relationships all your life. You know, you learn what's important, what's not important, and some conversations just aren't necessary. You don't have to have that. You don't have to tell somebody what you believe. Because it won't change what they believe. And again, you talk about the world we're living in right now. There's a lot of perceptions following the presidential election in the US and what's going on in other parts of the world right now.
What are you talking about?
that little incident that occurred in November,
I didn't know what you were talking about.
Yeah. The earthquake.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there are a lot of perspectives, you know. As a Brit, most Brits I know can't understand why anyone would vote in the way they did. Yet, 75 million, 76 million people did. So you have to understand that there is a perspective out there that says this person is the best person and the other person wasn't. So I can't just dismiss that and say 74 million Americans are stupid, because that's not the case. They're intelligent human beings.
That's not the case. I mean, so I think talking about that is, you know, a lot of things. So I'm 59, and so I was born in 65. And in my experience of America in that limited time, the country economically had a huge boon after World War II, where you had a lot of people in the country in what was called the middle class. And people could have good lives. I mean, just good lives where one person worked, or, you know, like in the 80s, that it started getting worse when then two people had to work. And the people in the middle of the country, certain economic groups were not properly supported, not properly fed. We had an exodus of jobs. A lot of jobs left this country. And so all these things had an impact on people. Like, their lives are not better, right? Even though some people's lives might be better because they were economically better off. But a lot of people in this country, it's like they're not better off. So, yeah, I mean, there's that reality. You can't deny that reality. You can't say that that's wrong, because it's not, right? And I have a faith in people and in America that I think the worst thing we ever experienced was the Civil War. The real Civil War, right, where we had bifurcation of the country. And we got through that. And I think we'll get through this, and we'll be better off for it. And the world will be better off for it. I believe in people. Like, I believe, because you can have ideas. I get that. But people, bottom line, we want to be loved. We want peace. People want to be cared for and safe. And that, I think, is going to pull us through. I know it's completely, like, people will be listening to this and saying that I'm an optimist, but I think I'm a realist, because I think that's what human beings fundamentally are. And where I sit, I can look at the news, which is a really horrible filter to see the world through, because the news is skews what's actually going on to benefit the news, right? But when you get to meet as many people as you and I have, and Joe, you said you meet hundreds of people a month, would you say most of the people you meet are good people?
Sure, for sure, yeah.
Right. And I imagine most of the people listening will be like, I'm a good person. I want to be a good person. So, like, that is the pillar I stand on when I can say, you know, with a certain amount of confidence that we're going to be great. It's going to be great.
Mm. Well, I go on LinkedIn, as we do, and I see people who have less than positive views about transgender people, people like myself. And they're not bad people. They have a view. They have a reason for their belief that is based in their own lived experience, their own reference points, their own needs. So it's just they're not trying to cause harm. They're just trying to create a world that works in their image, if you like. I'm trying to just create a world that works in my image. So we've just got to reference the fact that, and I spend time looking at their posts about other things they talk about, and you can see they're trying to do good in the world. Yeah. So what you've got to try and do is see the good in people. We have a different perspective on one topic, but the goal is the same.
Yeah, spot on. I mean, for me, it was like 10 years ago, if you would have said, well, what is diversity? I would have been like, well, it's, you know, what I can see, you know, the skin color, your gender, your age. But like, oh my God, now it's like a completely, my mind has opened up. I have new distinctions. I know more. That, you know, the things that I can see are more important. How we learn, how we deal with conflict, all of our styles are way more important as far as like having a solid team, or what we call diversity, or a diverse workplace, or an inclusive workplace. So language, I think, is really key. Like if anyone is suffering in the world, look at your language, look at your thinking, and kind of examine it and see, like, well, what do I know about what it is that I'm doing? I think one of my superpowers, I didn't write that down, is that I am truly a lifelong learner. Like, I'm getting a master's degree in cognitive neuroscience. And I got to tell you, sometimes I wonder why, because it's so freaking hard. Because it's hard to make those new neural connections. It's hard to learn. It's hard to learn, right? It's easier to not learn than it is to learn. But it's the only thing that will progress us, right? If we keep learning. And that takes work.
So we talk about the biases, and we also talk about perceptions and perspectives, and inherently we're all kind. And we also talked about belonging. How can we nudge people to become awake, to be conscious about this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I get that a lot. I mean, often my sponsor, who's like the head of HR, will bring me in and they'll be like, hey, my executive team, they're so biased. Fix them. Okay. First off, people can't be fixed because, one, they're not broken. And two, like, when the best thing to do for any of this stuff is what I, and I'll make it super like as simplistic as possible. Raise your own level of awareness in every way possible. You can't raise someone else's level of awareness. I do this professionally. I am a facilitator. I can do this because I have done this for a long time and I don't tell people anything. I just create a context, right? So it's a very nuanced approach. Changing someone's mind is probably the hardest thing to do. But it's the hardest thing to do. And the best thing for you to do, if you're interested, if this is at all of interest to you, is to work on your own thinking. Is to be like, okay, in a week, I'm going to be thinking differently about something that I think about now. And now that is the way to have a world that works. And, you know, often that's what inspires other people. I know like that to me is what inspires me. Like my mentor, when I read my mentor's book, I'm like, oh yeah, this inspires me. Like, I love this. Howard Ross is my mentor. He's been doing this kind of work for 30 years. And then like specific things are like, you know, like real basic things is to breathe, right? You can just inhale, count to four, hold your breath, count to four, let it go, count to four. You just do that whenever you feel like you're like, and it will, what it does is it shifts the energy from your amygdala, which is like your fear response center, to your prefrontal cortex, right? So your prefrontal cortex, your amygdala gets triggered. It goes back to your hippocampus, brings that memory forward. You're in this state that you talked about before. That breathing will redirect your energy to your prefrontal cortex, which is where all the good decision-making comes from. So those are like two things. Another thing I tell people to do is stand-up meetings. So there was this group of surgical teams in Chicago. And what they started doing was, you know, they'd come into the surgery and they'd go around the room and they'd say their name and they'd say what they're doing. So it'd be like, my name's Lorne, I'm the anesthesiologist, and we're going to cut this guy's leg off. And you'd go around the room, right, like that, real quick. And the reason they did that was because sometimes they would cut the guy's arm off, right? And so in a surgical room, that's really bad. But doing that, when small teams have to make a decision, an important decision, is to come together and have a quick, like, okay, what are we doing here? Like, particularly for interviewing, like, get together. Or, like, we're going to hire somebody, or we're going to fire somebody, or we're going to promote somebody. Decisions where it's actually important, it's important to kind of come together really quickly and understand. And then the three things I think to remember for all, like, decision-making that really has, I'm going to add four. These four things. One is timing, right? So how much time you allot to make a choice is super important. And this isn't like I'm going to McDonald's or Burger King. This is, you know, investment choices, important choices, particularly repeatable ones, is to look at the outcome of a decision. And if it worked, look at how much time you gave yourself to make it or your team to make it and see if there's a trend, right? So if there's a certain amount of time that works, great, because we've all made decisions too quickly or taken too long. So timing is really important. And the second thing is information. So when we make decisions, we make them based on what we know, tacit knowledge, right? Except a lot of the times we make it decisions, big decisions, based on information outside of us, the information that's coming to us, data that's coming to us. And that information has to have two components. One, it has to only address the question that we're asking and no more. Because our human brain isn't really good with data and numbers, right? The second thing is that it has to have providence. Like, is it true? Do we know it's true, whatever is coming to us? Is it true information, and does it address the question? Those are the three things. And then the fourth is our body. So our physical body is how we function, how our brain works, right? We, like, for instance, if your tryptophan is low and your serotonin then goes down, you're not going to make the best decisions. So are you hydrated? Are you rested? Are you, like, is your physical body in the right state to make this really important decision? Because if it's not, then your brain will not operate optimally. So those four things are really important around, like, kind of truths around decision making.
Yeah, one of the things I've always, excuse me, try to do is check in where people are at. Because we can make assumptions about someone's readiness to receive information or to communicate when, as you say, we've got to make sure that they're in the right headspace, they're feeling safe, they're ready to engage, their amygdalas all fired up, ready to fight. Yeah, just checking on people sometimes and having that, how are you doing? What's going on in your life? Where are you with this? Because if we don't do that, we're trying to meet logic with emotion sometimes, or our readiness and their readiness on two different planes, and we can end up falling out because we're not ready to communicate. And so it's establishing those communication channels first and then looking for this positive outcome and being committed to a positive outcome. Even if it's a negative topic, it can still be delivered with a positive outcome. Even making someone redundant or firing somebody, they still respect you for the way you handled it.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's true, 100%. And that takes a lot of work. Like, you know, you have to have, you know, the conversation before you have the conversation to make sure that you can have that conversation. Like, hey, when things aren't good, like I always think, like, hey, it's not the, like, when things are great, everything's great. But I always ask, like, when I was working in corporate America, it's like, okay, what do we do when things don't work out? How do we handle problems? Because that's when things go sideways. And that's when people feel bad. Or you could say something or do something that would make somebody feel bad. And, you know, that's not good. That's not good for work. That's not good for life.
It's not. And I talk about having challenging conversations, and we have thousands of conversations all the time, but we only remember or get anxious about the ones that are challenging because they're out of our comfort zone. We're having to either deliver bad news or correct something. And what are we worried about? We're worried about how the other person's going to react. We can't predict, or if we can predict, often we're scared to have those conversations. And, you know, I often talk about the fear of getting it wrong is this biggest barrier to inclusion, biggest barrier to world peace. We're so invested in our own sense of right, aren't we?
Can I tell you that's so, that could be more spot on. And I think I know where it came from. I think it comes from high school. Like, I don't know what high school was like in England, but here in high school, and it doesn't happen before high school, but in high school, if I raised my hand to ask a question or had an answer, and I got it right, what do you think my mates say?
Party pants or...
Exactly.
Yeah, teacher's pet, yeah.
If I raised my hand and I got it wrong, what did my mates say?
Yeah, idiot, dunce.
Here I am in my primary institution of learning, the palace of learning, and I can't ask a question. I can't raise my hand because I'm always afraid. And
fear of judgment, isn't it? Like,
yeah, sorry?
Fear of judgment. Fear we're going to be judged negatively, yeah.
And the fear of not belonging, not being loved. And so that's where it all comes from. It all comes from all that other, that history stuff, that way back stuff. And if not high school, maybe before high school.
We talked about earlier about things we remember, things we don't remember. We generally don't remember things we get right. It's things we get wrong or things where we have to learn or change or adapt. Those are the learning outcomes. Getting things right, we could go on for half our life getting the same thing right every time without realizing we're doing it, until the one day we get it wrong and we go, ah, now I get it.
Yeah, because when we were formed, the way our brains were formed was in a dangerous place where, you know, the outcome of you getting it wrong way back then was you die, right? The outcome of you getting it right was kind of like, okay, whatever. the stimulus was just so much stronger if you messed up.
Yeah. And, you know, what child ever learns to walk first time with the first step? They don't.
Right.
They fall over. They bang their head. They scrape their knee. You ride a bicycle. You fall off. You think, I'm not going to do that again. And you learn very quickly by making mistakes. We have to create workplaces and society where people can fail safely.
Right. And you can see this in children, like what I'm saying about where there's a transformation, where we're, like, kids have no problem being wrong. If you ask a bunch of 4-year-olds, how many of you can sing, they'll all raise their hand. You ask a bunch of 40-year-olds, how many of them can sing, maybe one. Right. Everyone can sing, but kids aren't afraid of failing because no one judged them. They didn't have. So you can see it somewhere in that development period where kids go from like being this joyful, lit up, exuberant, I'm just going to be like whatever I am, to then like all of a sudden buttoned up, shut down, controlled, scared. I don't want anyone to see me. I'm afraid of being judged. I mean, I'm laughing. I shouldn't laugh because it really is very sad, but you can see it. We can all see it. Even if you don't have kids, you can see kids. And at some point along their development, they become like the rest of us.
Yeah, some of the rest of us, right? I went through a phase of my life where I was doing a lot of karaoke, and I can't sing well. I can sing. We can all, as you say, we can all sing. I know I can't sing well. I was thrown out of the school choir because I had a very bad tonality, if you like. Another incident with this bank, actually. It was Chinese New Year, and we were in Hong Kong, and we went to the Hong Kong Bankers Club, and they had a karaoke night at the Hong Kong Bankers Club. And I remember standing on stage singing something to this room full of bankers, all pretty drunk. And I just sung my heart out. I do karaoke quite often. I have no fear of being terrible, but I love the ability to have that freedom to express yourself and pour your heart into something like no one's listening. And I think it's taught me to not get caught up in your own fear of failure. Just go and sing karaoke somewhere. No matter how much you hate doing it, go and do it. Shout at the scream at the top of your voice on a street corner, whatever it may be. Just get it out there and overcome that fear.
Yeah, I mean, fear is the thing to be afraid of, right? The only thing to fear is fear itself, right? That is the, and that stops us from growing. It stops us from doing the right thing. Stops us from like things where, oh, I should say this to that person. Oh no, I'm afraid that they may, even though and I guess one way to do it is to just freaking do it and, you know, balls out and have the experience.
But saying to somebody, you'll be okay, doesn't always fix the problem, does it? It's so ingrained. I talked to our daughter about this, and she's got some anxieties. And I said, look, imagine yourself smiling and being proud of yourself afterwards. Or every time you're going into something you have a fear or anxiety about, capture that moment, then capture how you feel when you've done it, and then replay the difference that it was unfounded. And it's all very well for me to have those coaching techniques, but it's not so easy for people to step up and enact it. It still takes an open mindset and growth mindset to do that.
Yeah, that's true. And I think like if you really want to give like, okay, this is what I would do with someone is start small. Right. Start in, you know, within their comfort zone and build confidence, because confidence can be built. Right. So that you can, if you're going from, I don't want to be in front of people, start with, you know, being in front of one person and then, you know, more people. Like I wrote a book some years ago, and I've been writing all my life, and my teachers would read my writing. But when I gave my book to people, I was so embarrassed and ashamed because of the now people could judge what I wrote. And it was just super scary, right? I mean, it was just, I didn't know how scary it was going to be. So I think, you know, that happens where you just kind of fall into it, or you can take small steps, you know, and figure out like, well, what can I do that is a little scary, but not as super scary, and keep building on that to build confidence. I mean, that's just like you're talking about, like, well, what could people take away from this conversation? Now, there's no one answer for that, but it's a way to approach the problem in general of fear, right? That we can overcome our fears.
And I think some of it's down to calibrating your sense of success as well.
Because
we can get hung up with perfection. If we calibrate success, no one's done. Yeah, if you're a pilot or a brain surgeon, nobody died. That's success. You know, you may not have had the perfect outcome, but the person had the worst case was someone, this person was going to die on the table. The best case is they've got slight numbness in their face or something, or they've got a slight numb finger still, but actually on a scale of things, they're alive. So success is relative, isn't it? So calibrate your success.
Yeah. I'll share a recent failure that was really traumatic to me. So I got my first master's about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago. And I did so well. I was inducted into an honor society. I got A's and A pluses. I started my master's in neuroscience a year and a half ago. I got A's and A pluses. This semester, our midterm, right? I was flying back from someplace and I came to the test tired and I flunked the midterm. Like I had never failed. I haven't failed a test since I was in high school. And it was really difficult. I mean, it was like really, I had a lot of shame and a lot of embarrassment and a lot of like, wow, like I must be stupid, and feeling judgment from the teacher, whether she had it or not. And so to move past it, I just took it more seriously and I just studied harder. Like I did more work. And I, you know, I aced the final, which was last week. But it was stressful. But I knew like, okay, just push through and push through. What was the worst thing that happened? Like, okay, I'm not going to fail the class. But look at where for me, it was like looking in the when I was in high school or before then, failing classes, not doing well, feeling my parents' judgment and all that, that was still there. Even after getting great grades, it's still there.
You mentioned your book, wanting that to be perfect and a testament to your knowledge. How did you overcome that?
So I write my book about the time that I meet my wife. And my mother-in-law is a published author. And my father-in-law is a seriously published author. And my wife is a published author. So when my wife and I met, she said, the first thing she said on our first date was like, don't Google me. And I'm like, okay, like, all right, fine. This is 2005. So I meet her, like 2 minutes later, I come to her house, her mother's there. And she's like, oh, mom, Lauren wrote a book. And she pulls my book off the bookshelf and her mother grabs it and she's standing in front of me. And remember, I was already feeling nervous about people reading my book. And my future mother-in-law is now thumbing through my book in front of me. I will never forget that. It was so uncomfortable, you know, because after that, I read it again and I saw all the mistakes and the grammar errors and stuff. And like, you know, so it was a real growth. Like it was an opportunity to kind of be real with like, okay, no matter how bad it is, it's just going to be what it is, right? It's just is what it is.
Yeah, because I've been hung up about, I've got a couple of books in me and I've kind of been hung up on the fear of judgment because as you say, it's published, it's out there. You can't, good thing about talking and speaking for a living, it's transient. You know, once it's gone, it's gone. But one of the books I'm in the middle of writing at the moment is based on the podcast series. So trying to create poetry using AI from the podcast. And my mum is really into poetry. She's in poetry groups. She writes poems. She's been a real kind of I would consider her quite a knowledgeable person around poetry. So I sent her a draft of my book, which is 300 pages, 150-ish poems based on the podcast series. And all I wanted her to really say to me was, yeah, it's okay. I want to know if she'd read a few and she felt like she could read a few more. That's what I was interested in. I didn't want to expect her to read the entire book. And she came back and she gave me some poetry books. She said, what I think you should do is you should read some of these poetry books because they'll give you an idea of how to structure poems and you know, some of the... I said, Mum, you missed the point. I'm not going to rewrite these poems. I'm not after that level of feedback. All I want to know is the book shit or not? That's all I want to know. Yeah, is it good enough? I don't. It doesn't want to be a masterpiece. And she said, "Well, you'd be better off if you remove the capital letters at the front of some of the sentences." I said, "Look, it's written by AI. I'm not going to edit the AI. The whole idea is I'm going to give you this raw AI content, and that's the USP of the book. It's written by AI, unashamedly. I'm not trying to human touch it too much."
Funny.
So I ended up having to take the books about poetry from my mum because she got a bit offended when I wouldn't take her advice. So I've got them on my shelf over there. So I'm going to have to flick through them because I'm going to see her at the weekend. She'll say, how do you get with a poetry book? Like, oh, yeah. Thank you. So I really appreciate it.
The Constitution of the United States was written by very educated men, and it has grammar mistakes. It has errors in capitalization, in punctuation, in ambiguous, in all sorts of like spelling words differently, redundancy. I mean, it's not like a well-written document from like what someone who is an English person would say, but it is the founding document of this country, which is, a great democracy. That's like, read the Bible, right? The Bible's got usually has lots of grammar mistakes.
Well, and conflicts of opinions and things. Sure. Yeah. It's full of contra. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So
but it's
unless everyone's going to read your book, don't worry about it. Or ever.
But that's kind of what I've kind of come to realize is I don't necessarily want to publish a book for you to read it. I want to publish a book so I've got one.
Yes.
That's right. The objective. So I've calibrated my success on having a book is having a book. Not that the whole world thinks it's a masterpiece. So I've calibrated doing it as being success. And maybe the second book, maybe I'll calibrate that to being I've done it and I'm proud of it and et cetera, et cetera.
See, Joe, now that you've said that, I am like so interested in reading your book. How off was Joe's perception of her writing versus my experience of her writing?
Yeah, well, actually, I'll send you a draft copy, and if you listen to this podcast, you'll be able to download it off of Amazon or wherever very soon. But yeah, I'll send you a draft.
Yeah,
love
to.
It's unashamedly, it's mostly written by AI, and you know. And I've made it quite clear.
But you were the prompt engineer.
Oh, yeah, I was the prompt engineer. I've curated it. I've fed it. I have tweaked it. I've tweaked the prompts. Yeah, completely. It's my voice in there. It's definitely my voice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, I think, that like if we were going to end the conversation of like people get to find their voice and use their voice and be powerful because every human being is powerful. Every human being has an amazing contribution to this world that we live in. I think that's really the bottom line of what I want. I think it's probably the bottom line of what you want. And how we can make the world better is everyone living of their best self, their true, authentic self.
And that feeds back into belonging. We have a purpose. We have a valued, we're credible. People respect us. We have something more than just ourselves. I think that's the belongingness where we feel part of society, part of our family, part of our workplace. And you say exactly what you're saying there. That's where we want to feel, isn't it? Belonging.
And I want to acknowledge your work, Joe, because like you, we don't talk a lot, but I see you on LinkedIn and I've gotten glimpses of your show. And I appreciate that you are standing in the gap. Like, where we are and where we could be around every human being feeling included, experiencing inclusion. I think that's great because it takes a lot of courage. I mean, it takes a lot of courage, takes a lot of faith, takes a lot of effort, energy, money, time, right? But really it takes the core of who you are, which is your values and your principles to say, okay, I'm going to do this and there's nothing else I could do. Because you could do other things, right, Joe? Like you could do other things, right? But you don't.
Completely.
Yeah, but you do this, right? And I think people who do this kind of work, who stand in the gap between where we are as where they think we are, where we feel we are, to where we could be, I think that's like the best work.
Lauren, we've been chatting away for over an hour now, and we met in the green room, had a good chat there as well. It's been absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
And a privilege, as I said at the beginning, a privilege to have this conversation, having your time to share your thoughts and perspectives. And I've loved reconnecting with you and it's been amazing. So how do people get hold of you?
Well, so I guess the period is I've really kind of focused on working with hospitals in that I provide medical education credits and to doctors, nurses. They can go to my website, which is laurenepstein.com. That's the best way to reach me. I do these workshops. I have a learning platform where people can come and just do the workshops like 24/7. And we're constantly adding to the content. You know, everything we do is academically based and has efficacy. So I love working with people. And it's funny because when I went to HR Vision, like I had this idea, oh, wow, like I do work in Europe. That'd be kind of cool. So I don't know. Do most people who listen to your show, are they European?
I would say predominantly European, but I've had guests from the US, from Australia, from across the world. So yeah, predominantly I would say European, English speaking European.
People, I mean, I'm sure there'll be a link here, but I wanted to just kind of tee up that Joe has told me that in a couple of episodes, this show is going to contain video, which is really exciting. So after 150 shows, is this right, Joe?
That's right. We're going to go video from 151 onwards. Yeah.
So you can see the people who she's talking to.
Cool? And that's cool. Bring it to life. Cause if you're listening to this, we can see each other. We've got cameras on and we're making gestures to each other. And I think what we're doing is yes, radio and audio is a great medium for people who are running, jogging, whatever. But I want to attract a new audience now who are watching, whether it's shorts, TikToks, reels, whatever it may be, or long form, just creating a different sort of engagement. And that's phase two, evolution.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like in our conversation, like you would with anybody, like when you're saying things that I agree with, I notice my head's bobbing up and down and I'm like, yes, 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 pointing to like, yes, that's exactly what you should be saying. That's exactly right. And that really does add to the conversation.
Hmm.
Plus, they can see my beautiful wife. See, that's my beautiful wife.
Yes, I did wonder who that was behind you. Yeah. Excellent. Oh.
My wife stopped the Pan-American Highway from going through Panama. She lived with the indigenous people in the Darien Gap in the jungles for 4 years. And help them stop the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund from funding this road that was going to go through the Darien Gap. And it still doesn't go through the Darien Gap. And that's because of her, my rock star woman, so Alicia.
That's her claim to fame, that human contribution to the world.
I thought marrying me
amongst
was
other
a
things.
Contribution. Yeah, marrying me, I think. She basically protected everyone else from me. So I think that was her.
Well, she sounds like a real hero, and maybe she'd like to come on the podcast and talk about her work in saving that part of the world. Then,
oh my goodness, it's a great story. Yeah, she's lovely. Yeah. She talks on values and culture because she knows all about.
I'll tap you up after we hang up here and get her details and see if we can persuade her to come and have a chat with me. Maybe she could be one of my first video guests. Who knows? Yeah, it'd be fantastic.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you so much.
It's been absolutely a blast. Thank you so much. And let me go to the outro. Thank you so much. As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.